Jeffrey Larson completed two psychology degrees from BYU and then earned a doctoral degree in marriage and family therapy from Texas Tech University. His research specialties include couple assessment and therapy, the predictors of marital satisfaction and stability, and premarital, marital, and remarital education approaches. Dr. Larson recently was elected chairperson of the family therapy section of the National Council on Family Relations. For the last 18 months, he has served as editor of the professional periodical, The Journal of Couple and Relationship Therapy. Professor Larson received the Distinguished Alumnus Award from Texas Tech University in 2001, and last year received the Alumni Professorship Award from BYU. He's been married to Diane Jean Larson for 37 years, and they are the parents of four. We now have the opportunity to hear from Brother Jeffrey Larson.
Brothers and sisters, I'm honored to be before you today in this devotional setting. I never imagined, as a BYU student in 1968, that in my future I would ever have something important enough to say that several hundred students would show up to hear me. Unless, of course, they were getting course credit and I was taking roll. I appreciate the confidence others have shown in me by asking me to speak to you. Since I always start class with a joke or something humorous, I will do the same today to get you in a better mood and to help me relax. Plus, it is awfully quiet in here. I was recently searching the want ads in the newspaper and found some interesting ones. As an editor, I generally read things carefully. Evidently, some people do not edit their ads before they publish them. Here's some that I found. You might like these. This one says, "Illiterate? Write today for free help." I like this one. "Dog for sale. Eats anything and is fond of children." Where'd the kids go? This was unintended. This was unintended. But it says, "For sale. Antique desk suitable for lady with thick legs and large drawers." It's the table. It's the desk. It's... "Free puppies, half cocker spaniel, half sneaky neighbor's dog." This is tragic, but it says, "Nice parachute, never opened, used once." Now to more serious matters. When I was a young boy, 13 years old, I was about to enter junior high school in Grand Junction, Colorado. I'm the oldest of five boys and thus felt some pressure to accomplish great things and be a good example for my four younger brothers. I expected that junior high would be difficult. I wouldn't know all the kids since in junior high we came from different elementary schools. The thought of going from classroom to classroom made me wonder if I would get lost and look like a fool. I wondered, what if some of the teachers are mean? And I was most worried about how skinny I was at the time and my new crop of pimples. When you think about it, how does anyone survive junior high school? Most of all, I worried that I may not compete well academically with the other students, as being a scholar was my goal. So I was a bundle of nerves that summer of 1962. Fortunately, I was blessed with a great mom who always seemed to be able to calm me down. This is her and I. Oh, feel the same way. This is her and I making homemade fudge together in 1953. The Salt Lake Tribune took the picture and published my mom's great no-cook fudge recipe. This is where I got my sweet tooth, by the way. Finally, my mom calmed me down with one of the wisest, most caring, and rational statements a mom could make to her worrywart son. She said, "Jeff, we don't care what your grades are. All we expect is that you do your best. If you do your best, we will be proud of you regardless of your grades." With that statement, my anxiety was cut in half, and I started looking forward to junior high school. After all, I could not control my final GPA, but I could control how hard I tried. I couldn't control my intelligence, which was average. Okay, maybe a little bit above average. How mean the teachers would be, how smart the other students would be, or even my final grade in any particular class. But control my levels of dedication and effort, I could do that. My mom taught me the value of setting realistic expectations in life that day. She taught me that process or effort is more important and manageable than the final outcome. Process is everything, as we say in family therapy. So for over half a century of living, I've used her wise counsel in my life to accomplish much, get over my failures, keep perspective in all that I do, and not beat myself up when I don't succeed the first time. Thus, my topic today is, what do you expect? A key to personal happiness. My question for you today is, what do you expect of yourself and life? And how are your expectations influencing how happy you are day to day? Expectations are thoughts or beliefs we have about ourselves, our relationships, and what happens to us in life. They are crucial as they are standards or yardsticks by which we judge what happens to us and how satisfied or unsatisfied we are with ourselves and life. I want to focus on two kinds of expectations today: what we expect of ourselves and what we expect of our relationships. I want to start with two kinds of thoughts or expectations we sometimes have of ourselves and life that get us into trouble. They can lead to depression, anxiety, and a sense of failure. Avoiding these expectations or thoughts we carry around in our heads can change our way of looking at the world and ultimately how we feel emotionally. They directly affect whether or not we are happy. The two popular thinking errors we humans seem destined to make and which can cause us much misery in life were first scientifically identified by world-renowned psychologists Aaron Beck and David Burns, both cognitive behavioral psychotherapists. They discovered 10 thinking errors or cognitive distortions that cause us emotional pain. They are at the root of depression, anxiety, and poor self-esteem. I will focus on two especially common ones and the related problem of perfectionism. They are, one, all-or-nothing thinking, and two, overgeneralization. Theory and research over the last 50 years shows that emotions or feelings are based not on the event or the world we perceive, but rather how we interpret events and the world. This is referred to as the cognitive therapy approach in psychology. Burns' important book is called Feeling Good, the New Mood Therapy. It is from that source that I will quote. First, I refer to this figure that shows the theory in a simplified manner. Quote, "This shows the relationship between the world and the way you feel. First, the world consists of a series of positive, neutral, and negative events. Second, you interpret the events with a series of thoughts that continually flow through your mind. This is called your internal dialogue or self-talk. Your feelings are created by your thoughts and not by the actual events. All experiences must be processed through the brain and given a conscious meaning before you experience any emotional response. This model emphasizes that we don't usually simply just feel an emotion spontaneously, but rather we create our feelings from our thought processes. Depending on our thoughts, we can experience certain feelings. This model has been widely supported by empirical research in the field of psychology, and the Burns approach is generally recognized as one of the most potent treatments in all of psychotherapy for treatment of a wide variety of emotional disorders. Now, lest you think, or shall we say, expect, that problems like depression and anxiety are uncommon, it is predicted that more than 1 in 4 of you will have one of these problems sometime in your life. Or you may know someone with these problems, and you may be in a position to help. Scriptural support for Beck and Burns' theory can be found in the following. Proverbs 23:7. For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. President Ezra Taft Benson emphasized, quote, daily, constantly, we choose by our desires, our thoughts, and our actions whether we want to be blessed or cursed, happy or miserable. Norman Vincent Peale exclaimed, change your thoughts and change the world. Now let me demonstrate how these cognitive distortions or unrealistic expectations of ourselves in life can harm our mental and relationship health. First, let's look at the problem of all or nothing thinking. This is also called black and white thinking. We do this when we think of life's events and people in extreme categories, black or white, righteous or unrighteous, good or bad. You may think, since I flunked that quiz, that means I'm a failure. Or, since she turned me down for a date, that proves I'm a loser. This is also referred to as catastrophizing. I love that term. Catastrophizing. These cognitions or thoughts will cause you to be depressed. But if instead, after you got off the phone, you said to yourself, wow, too bad for her. She missed a chance to go out with the best-looking guy in Provo. That's her loss, not mine. Let's get another phone call going. Okay, you would then feel less depressed. Of course, you may also be exaggerating your own personal qualities a bit. The fact is, most of what happens to us cannot be thought of in black and white terms or all or nothing terms. No one is absolutely brilliant or totally stupid. People are not absolutely righteous or unrighteous. We are all just more or less so. Fact is, much of life is gray, not black and white. Related to all or nothing thinking is the cognitive habit of overgeneralization. This happens when you arbitrarily conclude that something that happened to you once will occur over and over again. This is analogous to dropping a drop of black ink into a container of water, clear water. Soon the whole container turns gray or black. It is exemplified in the earlier example of the young man who, after being turned down for a prospective date, decided he was the world's biggest loser. We use all or nothing thinking and overgeneralization in the service of another toxic habit called perfectionism. Perfectionism is defined as the obsessive and rigid desire or expectation that we must do things perfectly or life is not good. Sometimes we apply it to even trivial things like mopping a floor or straightening up our desk. By the way, a clean desk is the sign of a sick mind. I have several colleagues who can vouch for that. If something is not done just right, perfectly, we consider ourselves a failure. It is directly related to all or nothing thinking. Either I'm a success or a failure. Either I'm perfect or imperfect, and I cannot stand not to be perfect. Average is not for me. Perfectionism, or having unrealistic or irrational expectations about ourselves or our relationships, is a chief cause of depression, anxiety, and obsessive-compulsive disorders, as well as relationship problems. Perfectionism leads to procrastination, which leads eventually to paralysis. We call these the three P's. A college student who was a client of mine several years ago, related this story about his perfectionism. Quote, I set so high standards for projects I did that when I thought about even starting a project, I would feel anxious and nauseous. That would lead to me procrastinating beginning the project, even doing one section of it. Eventually, it led to me feeling paralyzed. I remember staring at the instructions from the professor, getting anxious, then waiting till the last minute to quickly do the project, and at the last minute, turn it in the next day. My perfectionism led to me getting less than perfect grades on projects. When I asked this young man to make a list of advantages and disadvantages of his perfectionism, he came up with 4 advantages. For example, he thought he did a better job when he was perfectionistic, although his grades did not show it. Then he listed 17 disadvantages to perfectionism, some of them just discussed. At this time, he started reconsidering the value of perfectionism in his life. Even God does not expect us to be perfect in this life. It simply cannot be done. Norma Ashton, speaking to the BYU women, said, quote, "Know that you don't have to be perfect. We aren't even expected to achieve perfection in this life, but rather to make steady progress toward it. We are masochists sometimes, and I think we allow ourselves to succumb to the failed diet syndrome. You overeat one time and think, that's it, I've blown it. No reason to stay on the diet now. When we fall short of the mark, we feel we've blown it. We'll never be able to measure up to everything we've been told to do. So in effect, we give up. This thought pattern is very clever and a successful tool of the adversary. We must keep trying, but we must be able to forgive ourselves when we can't do it all. We can make do with our present and look forward." This suggests a more rational and productive way to think about life. Just do your best. Like my mom said, I like these quotes from other wise people. Quote, "Happy people do their part, do their best, then let go and let God do the rest. They do what they can within their circle of influence." Or from Alcoholics Anonymous, quote, "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." This prayer has been successfully used in Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 70 years. These ideas suggest that process is more important than outcome. Burns suggests developing a process orientation to life. Quote, "This means you focus on processes rather than outcomes as a basis for evaluating things. This more rational way of thinking emphasizes that the journey is the destination." I love that. The journey is the destination. And don't audit life. Show up and make the most of it now. Let's apply this process idea to a common problem today, looking for a job. Some of you may be doing that, or will soon. When you're applying for work, do not make it your aim to get the perfect job. Instead, make it your aim to do your best to develop a great resume, contact employers, and interview well. Most people who get a decent job do so after first receiving an average of 10 to 15 rejections. Now, does that make sense? Is that what happened to you? That's what happened to me, 10 to 15 rejections. This is because the outcome of job hunting depends on many more factors than just you. The outcome depends on many factors outside your control. For example, how many other applicants there are, their qualifications, who knows the boss's daughter, etc. So instead, focus on what you can control, and that's your effort. If you make a great effort each day, you should feel proud and satisfied. You'll feel less depressed and discouraged than if you expect that landing a great job is success. And you'll eventually land a job, maybe even a great job. Now, what should we do when we make mistakes? What should our expectations be then? Burns emphasizes, quote, "It is good to make mistakes because then we learn. In fact, we won't learn unless we make mistakes. No one can avoid making mistakes. And since it's going to happen in any case, we may as well accept it and learn from it," unquote. He also said, "We don't die if we make mistakes, unless you're skydiving." Focus instead on what you can learn from your mistakes. An example of this for me happened when I was in the U.S. Coast Guard, being trained as an officer and a gentleman at Officer Candidate School in August 1974. The platoon leaders lined us up each day at 6 a.m. to inspect our uniforms for any dirt, wrinkles in our shirts, unshined shoes, and even lint on our black uniforms. And white lint really showed up on those black uniforms. I got gigged or punished every time they found anything out of order, even something very minor. When you were gigged, you lost points on a chart, and if you lost enough points, they kicked you out of the program. During the first 2 weeks, I lost 20 points and was getting really discouraged. Then it occurred to me, instead of beating myself up over my mistakes, use them as learning experiences. After that, each time I got gigged, I wrote down a note to myself of what not to do next time. Eventually, I was passing inspection every week, not losing any points. Looking back, the platoon leaders were purposely finding any little mistake to nail us for just to see how we would react. There was no such thing as a perfect uniform after all. If we catastrophized and got angry or discouraged when we got gigged, their conclusion was that certainly we would not be able to handle stress well enough at sea to be leaders in the U.S. Coast Guard. And they were right. In reality, the secret of happiness is to set modest or realistic goals and accomplish them. Climbing mountains is important, but each of us has our own mountain to climb. And we decide what is a successful climb. A good example of using this principle occurred in my own life about a year ago in September 2008. My oldest son, Jeffrey, his wife, Cheriston, and their son, Cameron, invited me to take a hike to the top of Mount Timpanogos. Beautiful place. Since coming to BYU 22 years ago, I always wanted to do that. Every time I looked up at that most beautiful mountain north of our campus, I thought, I've got to climb to the top of that someday. Many of you have. I agreed to go, but then I discovered the hike was almost 12 miles round trip. And of course, the first 6 miles were all uphill. And this was in the heat of the summer. Now, I was close to 60 years old at the time, and I wasn't in very good shape. But I figured if I took it easy, drank a lot of water, I could make it. And Jeff and Cheriston were experienced backpackers, so I felt safe with them. Plus, my son Dylan agreed to take my 40-pound backpack most of the way up the trail for me. What a thoughtful son. I wouldn't have made it had he not done that. Well, we hiked for a whole day, and by the time we arrived about 1 mile from the summit and pitched camp, I found myself exhausted. I'd been stopping for a breath about every 75 yards for the last hour. I saw the top of that beautiful mountain, and I thanked God that I was there. But I also realized that I did not have the physical stamina to go to the very top the next day, plus hike down 6 miles with a full backpack, most likely in the middle of a rainstorm, which was forecasted for the next day. And actually, the next day, it snowed on us. That was September 1st. At that moment, I changed my expectations. I wisely decided I have climbed my mountain. I have seen the top. I have survived a hike I was not sure I would survive. I was joyous, but I had to fight off the normal protest from my son that I was only 1 mile from the summit, and I may someday regret not going to the very top. I told him, that's okay, you guys summit tomorrow. I have climbed my mountain. Now, some of you may think I wimped out by changing my expectations in the middle of that hike. That's understandable. However, had I gone on, I may not be here today making this speech. Little did I know at that time that the breathing problem I was suffering was due to 2 clogged arteries in my heart, which were 95% closed. which was not diagnosed and treated until just 2 months ago. Had I continued to the top of Temp that day, I might still be there, buried with a really good view. It was funny. My cardiologist, who did not know this story, told me after surgery in May, "You can pretty much exercise the way you were before, but don't go climbing Temp this weekend." Didn't need to say that. But how does God feel about our lack of perfection? I like this quote a lot. Quote, "God loves you because of who you," "God loves you because of who God is, not because of anything you did or didn't do." I've never heard it put that way. I really like that. What about the times when our expectations, even realistic ones, are not met? How do we best respond? The fountain of all knowledge, my mom, would say, "Count your blessings, it could be worse." Perhaps she got this counsel from a song I love. Let's look at the first verse of this song. "When upon life's billows you are tempest-tossed, when you are discouraged thinking all is lost." All is lost! Oh, I didn't make it to the top of Temp. I didn't get an A on my quiz. All is lost! It's the end of the world as we know it. Oh, back to the song. Isn't it interesting the person who wrote that song said, "All is lost. We think all is lost." That is overgeneralization combined with catastrophizing. You learned that today. Excellent. It was worth coming. Help, all is lost. Back to the song. "Count your many blessings, name them one by one. And it will surprise you what the Lord has done." This is a strategy I try to use when trouble or discouragement shows up in my life. The message here is, take perspective with all your problems. If we compare our blessings to our misfortunes, my guess is most of us would have many of the former and fewer of the latter. It has been said, quote, "Happy people count their blessings, while the miserable complain about theirs," unquote. That's like complaining that you missed a call on your miniature computer attached to your ear, which is connected to a multi-million-dollar satellite circling the Earth hundreds of miles away, thanks to the work of many talented scientists. This device is also referred to as your cell phone. It'll even take pictures you can instantly send to your mother. What would the pioneers say if they heard this? What would the pioneers say? By the way, how many of you are texting right now? It's those saints with their heads down, not in prayer, but in texting. The texting God. Going through the texting God. Okay. Well, as President Monson said, everyone can be discontented if he ignores his blessings and looks only at his burdens. His perspective is everything. What about unrealistic expectations about relationships? I specialize in relationships, so here's a few. Here are a few that will get you into trouble. They're from my book for singles called Should We Stay Together? For those looking to get married, here are a few. Quote, "There is one and only one right person in the world for you to marry." This is, of course, an example of all or nothing thinking. Fortunately for most of us, there are several people in the world we could be happy with. Otherwise, why would people remarry after the death of a beloved spouse and be just as happy with the second spouse? Another irrational belief or expectation is, quote, "Choosing someone to marry is a decision of the heart." Fact is, if more people use their heads in the mate selection process, the divorce rate might not be nearly so high. Or do you believe this myth? Preparing for marriage just comes naturally. This is called the myth of naturalism. That it's just natural to know what it takes to be happily married. You don't need to take a class. Why spend your tuition money on that? Everyone knows how to be happily married. We simply learn it naturally from our parents and television. This is scary when you consider that half of the parents in the United States, and most on TV, are divorced. For the marrieds in the audience, here are a couple marriage myths for you to consider from my second book, The Great Marriage Tune-Up Book. Quote, if my spouse loves me, he or she should instinctively know what I want and need to be happy. This is the ESP, or extra sensory perception myth, expecting our partner to be able to read our mind. Another myth is, marriage can fulfill all of my needs. No, you still need a close relationship with God, good friends, family members, hobbies, and a good golf or tennis game to be happy, even if you are married. I hope you don't believe the myth that, quote, couples should keep their problems to themselves and solve them alone. Too many couples keep their problems to themselves until it's too late, and the relationship is so dysfunctional that it is nearly impossible to repair, even in therapy. Most couples who divorce say they never went to marriage counseling or they waited too long to go. If they could speak to us now, their message to us would be, reach out for help before it is too late. In conclusion, today I've made a case for carefully considering your expectations and thoughts about life in order to be happier. I want to end my talk with two quotes related to expectations about life from two of my favorite people, President Gordon B. Hinckley and his wife, Sister Marjorie Pay Hinckley. President Hinckley once said, quote, anyone who imagines that bliss is normal is going to waste a lot of time running around shouting that he's been robbed. The fact is that most putts don't drop, most beef is tough. Life is like an old-time rail journey. Delays, sidetracks, smoke, dust, cinders, and jolts, interspersed only occasionally by beautiful vistas and thrilling bursts of speed. The trick is to thank the Lord for letting you have the ride. My mom not only made great fudge, but she also had a great sense of humor. Sister Hinckley, like my mom, also had a sense of humor and said this, the only way to get through life is to laugh your way through it. You either have to laugh or cry. I prefer to laugh. Crying gives me a headache. It is my prayer that this message has not given you a headache, but rather some ideas to consider in improving your own personal happiness. By being more aware and then more realistic in our expectations and thoughts about life and other people, we can become happier than instead expecting life or others to change for us. I testify that my mom was right, and these principles are true, as I have tried to live them all the days of my life, and say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.